Good afternoon, everyone. I'll jump right into the message today. You'll remember the first part of this, which was almost a month ago, a little 5 weeks ago, talking about what you can find in the Bible for science. But I'm going to start a little differently today and ask you a question. How confident are you? How confident are you? Your natural question would be about what? You see, think personal confidence. I'm going to ask, how confident are you about this way of life? How confident are you about God's way? How confident are you about God? Do you ever sometimes read the Bible and think back and think and kind of opine to a time when miracles were so obvious? Christ walked, things they saw, or maybe ancient Israel when they saw the pillar of fire and the cloud, these dramatic manna falling down from heaven. Do you ever think that, oh, if I would have lived in that time, it would have been easier to understand and be able to appreciate that there's a God? Because it's so much more real. Well, here we are in the modern age, thousands of years past the events that we're going to talk about today. We still see miracles. We see many miracles, some dramatic healings especially, other miracles. But God did something for our modern age that allowed us to be able to have the same sort of confidence that you would have had if there would have been a pillar of fire in front of you. Because everything that we talked about in part one of this, and we will today in part two, couldn't have been understood without modern technology able to prove it. So God inspired his word to include things that we wouldn't be able to understand until the modern day. In effect, giving us that pillar of fire or cloud or manna from heaven moments that simply can't be explained away. So I said this at the beginning of the other message. I'll say it here. What does this book mean to you? What is it? What's it for? Why do we have it? Why are we so careful with our Bibles? We put them in our briefcases or purses and put them back. There, can you think of any other book you own where you still have the cardboard box that you got that book in and faithfully put it back into the cardboard box and the sleeve on the outside of it and then put it into your brief? You're all laughing because you know exactly what I'm talking about. Until that cardboard is just tattered so badly you can't even use it anymore. And you probably even duct tape the cardboard. What other book do we do that with? Think about it. Let's go to Isaiah 41. We're going to refer to a couple of verses that we saw before and then go back into it and then cover some aspects that I didn't have time to do. I mentioned I had too much material the first time, and well, I probably do again. So we'll see how far we can get today. Isaiah 41. And we'll just read one verse here. So God challenges us to understand the things that we can understand. He says in verse 21 of Isaiah 41, present your case, bring forward your strong arguments. Declare the things that are going to come afterward, that we may know that you are gods. Indeed, do good or evil, be anxious, look about us and fear together. Prove your case. But those were false gods in those contexts, and they couldn't. Proverbs 14. Proverbs chapter 14, and just verse 15, one verse. 14:15, the simple believes every word, but the prudent man looks well to his goings. He considers his steps. So God says, present a case to show what's real, what's strong, what's powerful, which God says he will do, and therefore we must consider our steps or consider where we're going and not just simply believe everything. You got to dig. You got to look. You got to prove. That's why we say prove all things, hold fast that which is good. So let's do that for the rest of the time today. Let's continue proving God and his word through the smattering of science that's hidden in the Bible. Go to Romans 2. Again, a lot. We're going to start with some review. There's enough time has passed. I wanted to reframe this a little bit. Romans chapter 2 and verse 19 reads, "And are confident that you yourself are a guide of the blind, a light of them which are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, which has the form of knowledge and the truth in the law," a form of it. So there are all these people out there who think they are confident enough. Remember, we talked about confidence at the beginning. How confident are we that they can guide the blind? That they can be a light for them who are in darkness? They can instruct those who are foolish? They can teach babes? How confident are you that you could do that in relation to God's word? So the rest, most of the time, we won't leave the Old Testament, but I'll give you some of those dates that we talked about last time. So, creation to nearly 4,000 BC. I think 6,000-year plan of God, just slightly less than that. So that's the Old Testament creation account. You got to the flood, which is about 2,300 BC. So these are old dates. I think we're, let's say, 2020 today. 2,000 years gets us back to Christ's time. And then we're talking about things that are much, much further back. Job lived about 1750 to 1500-ish BC, depending on the account. And the Exodus was right around 1440 BC. That one's an important one because a lot of the events that we will talk about were written near that time. Because most of the Torah, those first five books of the Bible, were written right around 1400-ish BC. There's a period of time as the events played themselves out, the Exodus and time, but right around 1400 BC. Okay, so 2020 minus another 1400 years. So we're looking at 3,400 years ago. Most of what we're going to look at was written 3,400 years ago. Everything that we touch in the Old Testament is obviously thousands and thousands of years old. So let's get our minds back to where we are, because the danger in a message like this is you put your modern context, or we put our modern context on the things that we read in the Bible. If we do that, they're all a little bit duh. Like, of course we know that the earth sits in a gravitational field, or of course we know that the universe is expanding. It's the simple, for lack of a better term, duh. We know these things. But we have to get back to, in our minds, what was it like at around 1500, 1400 BC? I'll remind you of some of these things. This is cutting-edge science, cutting-edge technology in this period. They were at the height of the Bronze Age because they learned to mix materials with copper, so it was a little bit harder, because originally it was just copper. That's what they were using. And copper, if you've ever seen pure copper, you can shape it pretty easily. Then it took about 100 years, and suddenly they learned to mix other alloys, and they had iron. Iron. You know, the thing that you don't ever think about because it's so innate in our society and it's in the buildings and the cars that we don't even use anymore because it's not strong enough? Because all the modern alloys are much more complex than that. Iron. And then it took hundreds of years before society started actually using iron. You got into about the 1300s BC before it became more widespread as a tool for tools. Okay, some other inventions that were brand new. They discovered in Central America chocolate. That was an important one. They just started weaving flax to be able to create specific kinds of fabrics. So taking flax and making it into fabrics. Okay, here's one. Shoes. I kid you not. This was the period when they started to differentiate a left and a right foot for a shoe. Before, it would just be a simple thing wrapped around a foot. They were the same for both feet, and they fit loosely enough that it didn't matter. So they started wearing shoes. Okay, advanced societies. Porcelain. Porcelain was first developed in China, although it didn't leave China until 1000 AD, so 2,500 years later, before the rest of the world saw porcelain. There's another one. You read some of these and you think, okay, is that true? A couple of them I had to actually find multiple sources because I didn't believe the source. No, they had to have this. They didn't have until about 1400 BC oars for boats. Did someone like lean over the back and kick? Like oars. Hairbrushes. It was new. Cutting-edge technology. What did they look like if they didn't have hairbrushes? But they actually first used them for horses, and someone thought, oh, you know what? My hair's a mess. I should try that. Europe, Crete, Greece, and the Algeans, four countries or cultures, had literacy, as in there were four countries who could read in the entire world. Four countries. Chariots had been invented, but very few people used them because they were so new. Farming, although common in Europe and Asia, was just starting to appear in Mexico, Central America. And a great military change had happened. They had invented not gunpowder or guns or weapons of the sort. They started to switch out the bow and arrow with a crossbow. A crossbow. Because it wasn't actually as effective, but they could fire them faster. So that was the great military thing of the time, a crossbow. That's now what do people still use that? I think you can use them for hunting still. I think they're a little fancier now than what they were around 1400 BC. What's interesting is that actually is a fun fact. The crossbow was the dominant military weapon until about the 16th century, so into the AD times. So they obviously got better and better. So that's the environment of the time. That's the environment that some of the things you're going to read about and heard last time, the science of the day, this was the cutting edge technology. Had never been seen before, a crossbow. Because the dominant system, because they weren't doing much with swords either. So don't think, well, because you kind of picture in your mind maybe medieval Europe where they pull the sword out or you have the archer because there's a Robin Hood. No, they had bows and arrows. That was the only projectiles because, remember, they just started doing copper and iron. So they were not swords. Maybe sticks with rocks on the end of them or maybe copper now ends. But very, very simple technological cultures. They were doing things that were amazing because they hadn't been done before, but still, very simple cultures. Last time, I intentionally started big. Remember, we talked about the universe, how the Earth was positioned, solar systems, and we started drilling down toward the Earth. We got closer and closer and closer to our planet until we eventually, very quickly, covered one animal that we'll look at again, insect, that I just hit too quickly and I wanted to go into more detail. But first, let me quote just how off mankind can be. Here is an article titled, "Quantum Reality is Either Really Weird or It Collapses." The subhead is, "Either quantum state has to collapse to the macroscopic level or reality is not real." So a little bit of a science-y thing, but here, let me read it to you. Because basically what it's saying is we're a little bit uncomfortable that it seems like there's something bigger going on, but we don't want to admit to it. So what is this reality thing anyway, subhead? Continuing on, it goes into a bit here. So they assume there is no superdeterminism. which is the idea that we make free choices. If we reject local friendliness, some of these terms, then we have to make some decisions. We have to accept some of the following possibilities. An observer's measurements are not necessarily real. Reality is not local. Superdeterminism is real. We don't really make decisions. We can make decisions. Or quantum mechanics ceases to function somewhere before the macroscopic observers get involved. Okay, what are you talking about? Give me a second here. This is where it gets a little bit more than just science gobbledygook. However, the bigger point is that reality may depend on quantum effects washing out or basically disappearing before they get too large. Otherwise, reality starts to break down. The alternatives are that we have much less free choice than we think we do, which is science speak for there's something guiding things a lot more than we realize, comma, which is a bit unpalatable. Beyond that, we have to reject locality or causality, which might even be more painful for physicists. So we keep discovering things that starts to prove there has to be a God, but it's a little bit, as they termed it, unpalatable to determine that. Here's another fun science or universe one before we get back down to our planet. Think about the universe. It has to be finite. How do we know that? Because God clearly defines that there are three heavens. You have the first heaven, the second heaven, and the third heaven. If you have the first heaven, which is where we are, or sky, that has a finite aspect to it. You have the second heaven, which would connects to the first heaven. And then the Bible defines a third heaven, obviously heaven where God is, makes you wonder, how does the edge of the universe connect to the spiritual realm to allow it to be a third heaven, but would also define the universe in itself as being that second heaven being finite, which we understand today to be finite. But again, remember, 1,500 years ago when some of these terms were used. Okay, let's go to Proverbs 6. We have to keep reminding ourselves of the time that these words were written. Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6, and we'll read verse 6. Verse 6 reads, "Go to the ant, you sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest." I quickly mentioned that it's female workers for ants, but I want to do a little more digging. I want to spend a little bit more time, because is it just a coincidence that in that patriarchal society that they said her? So I wanted to look up the Hebrew. Her is not technically there, but that's often the case in Hebrew. You have to look at the word that it's modifying to be able to understand if it's masculine or feminine. So the word is ways in verse 6, meat in verse 8, and food in verse 8. Every single one of those words are over and over and over again in the Bible modifying a masculine or neutral object. So his food or his or the food. In this specific case, her ways and her food and etc. is a third person feminine singular. It was intentionally by God made feminine, made female, her. So add a little bit more to this. From an ant website, because there are ant websites. There are many of them when you research this sort of thing. But, quote, "Nearly all ants you see in the wild are female. Male ants or drones don't do any work in the colony, and they don't look like ants, more like wasps. They only live for a few months during the nuptial flight season. Their one job is to fertilize a queen or a princess to become a queen." I didn't realize ants differentiated, but after which they die. Not a good life to live if you're a male ant. So male ants breed, help them breed, and die. So all the ants you see, which is more than I even understood, are female. In fact, there are some ants that are actually asexual, but female, and can reproduce themselves by cloning. So the male's not even in the mix. Ladies, stop grinning. But think about that. God specifically said her. How would they have known that? They don't even look like ants. How would they have known that they're male ants? How would they have known the difference? Well, it was just an accident that God inspired the Bible to say her. Okay, that's the last before we start to really, we're going to get small today. We're going to look at things that you couldn't have seen thousands of years ago because you couldn't have seen them just hundreds of years ago before we had microscopes or modern medicine or modern technology. We're going to look at some basics of health and just go through as many proofs as we can get in before I run out of time today. I'll probably go over a little bit as well. So go to Genesis 2. Genesis chapter 2. And we'll read verse 7. Again, a lot of these verses you've read over and over again, but your modern bias makes me not realize how unique it is to be able to put some of these facts in here. Verse 7 reads, "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living soul." He was alive. So what's remarkable about that? Well, God formed man of the dust of the ground. It's the top layer of the ground. It's the premium part of the soil. It's not deep down. It's not the clay, because the clay would have less of these. It was only recently that we've learned that we are comprised of 28 base and trace elements that are found in the dust, the top layer of the soil. Why say dust of the earth instead of just saying man was formed of the ground or of the earth? Because we were formed from the dust. That's why we have those 28 elements, trace minerals, elements, and base elements in us. And interestingly, all of those are only found on Earth, not on other planets that we've been able to, or the moon, or what we've been able to discover, and Mars. And it's only here. So, again, coincidence or inspired word of God, Proverbs 17. I was able to get into some of the lighter ones. So we'll look at some really amazing ones, and we'll look at some that I would call interesting parallels that you can read a fascinating inspiration. If you wouldn't have had part one to build that foundation, it may not have hit you as hard, but we'll definitely have both. Some are amazing. Proverbs 17 and verse 22. Verse 22 reads, "A merry heart does good like a medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones." Okay, flip over to 18. Chapter 18, and then we'll read verse 14 of 18. "The spirit of man sustains his infirmity, but a wounded spirit," think broken spirit, "who can bear?" Who can handle? Because it pulls you down, because it dries the bones. Well, science has shown us that laughter reduces stress. It releases stress hormones. It releases endorphins, and that would make the merry heart to bring forward all of the items that allows your immune system to function more effectively. When you have those released into your system, your immune system can be boosted. When you're down or out or brokenhearted, it will actually tear your immune system down so it's less effective. And what does that do? You can't fight off disease. You get sick. It's like intense stress. If you have intense stress, if you lose someone that was very close to you, you've heard the term broken heart syndrome. It can literally simulate what happens in a heart attack when you go through something that difficult. Kind of dries the bones, doesn't it? Broken spirit. Okay. These are just some basic health ones. Proverbs 15. I'll read a quote to you that may be helpful on that last point while you turn there. Researchers have studied individuals with no prior medical problems who showed symptoms of stress, cardiomyopathy, including chest pain, difficulty breathing, low blood pressure, and even heart failure following an intense, stressful incident. Nothing else wrong with them. Their heart was always fine, but those are the conditions because they had a broken spirit. So God says being down can affect you, and now we understand. Proverbs 15, you're probably there. Verse 30. This is another one of those interesting ones. The light of the eyes rejoices the heart, and a good report makes the bones fat. So this doesn't say the light in the eyes rejoices the heart. It's talking about the light of the eyes. You can look up the words. It can also mean light going into your eye rejoices the heart. Okay, what does that mean? Why would light going into the eye get rid of sadness or makes the heart rejoice? Well, think about wintertime. When you stop getting out in sunshine and you stop getting all the warmth, you stop getting all that vitamin D, all that sunlight coming into you, so much so that they have a condition called seasonal depression disorder or SADS or whatever it specifically is called. And what do they tell you to do? Shine full spectrum lights on yourself because it will help lift your spirits. Or it will rejoice the heart. Simple little ones here. Again, like I did this last time, and they get bigger. Genesis 17. Again, why would God have phrased these in the way that he inspired them to be phrased if it was just happenstance? It was a lucky wording that by confirmation bias that we were able to, in the modern age, read into a verse to be able to find a meaning to it. It just happened to be. Okay, how about this one? Because you can't read into this one. Genesis 17, verse 11. And you shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant between me and you. Verse 12. And he that is 8 days old shall be circumcised among you, and every man child in your generations, he is born in the house or brought with money of any stranger, which is not of your seed. On the eighth day, you're to be circumcised. You know this in the church. You probably heard this before. But that's because something happens in your blood on the eighth day. It's an enzyme or protein, prothrombin, spikes to levels far above what is normal in your body on the eighth day. So it keeps going up. And so let's say this is 100% level that your body would have. It keeps going up and it skyrockets on the eighth day before it starts to come back down and rest at its normal level. Well, what's that protein? Why does that protein matter? Well, that's the blood clotting protein. It's one of many, but it's a primary function to clot blood. And if you're circumcising someone, you would want them to stop bleeding. So did God just randomly pick the eighth day, or did he inspire God's word in Genesis and then also built our bodies to be designed for it? Here's a fun chicken and egg. Did God create our bodies to spike on the eighth day and then inspired God's word to do it? Or was it the other way around? Did he decide, because he could have picked the third day or the fifth day or the 27th day, but yet he says, wait until the eighth day. So it's amazing because he was in control of both. He created us and he inspired the Bible. So it's one of those questions to ask in the kingdom. Speaking of babies, go to Genesis 3. Back a few chapters. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. Verse 15 reads, and I will put an enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and their seed, and it shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Okay, we know it's a prophetic statement, but what does it mean between your seed and her seed? think, okay, is that children and generations later? There are a lot of words that are translated seed that can mean offspring. This is not one of them. This literally means seed. Okay, why is that unique? Of course, men, egg and semen. So you have both sets of the equation to be able to make a child. So men have their seed and women have their seed. Why is that a big deal? Of course, they come together, contraception. They come together and you can have a baby. With contraception, you can avoid it. So why is that a big deal? Well, it wasn't until really a few hundred years ago that they actually understood that women carry eggs. Most of through time, a woman was looked at as simply an incubator for his seed. And that's how the baby developed. It was from the man, and the women just held it and cooked it, if you will. So God here in his word specifically said, no, there's one from each of them that come together to make the two different seeds. You may say, okay, are we reading into that a little bit? Okay, you can take it that way. Let's go look at some laws of hygiene, which is fitting for the modern day we're living in. We're thinking a lot about hygiene these days, aren't we? What particulates are we breathing out? What's our temperature? Not getting feast fever. Our hands washed. We're using sanitizers. Go to Leviticus 15. Leviticus 15. Question is, and all these is why? Why would God say it this way? Chapter 15 and verse 13. 13 reads, "And when he has an issue, is cleansed of his issue, then he shall number to himself 7 days for his cleansing, and wash his clothing, and bathe his flesh in running water, and he shall be clean." Running water. Why is that a big deal? Well, it's a big deal because no one understood anything about germs until the modern age. Literally, in the 1800s, they thought they should wet their hands. So you know what they did if you were a doctor in the 1800s? There was a big bin of water outside operating rooms, outside the morgue, outside where they had babies. And all the doctors, it didn't matter if you were just working on an autopsy or you were delivering a baby, you all walked over to the water, still water, cleaned your hands in that water, dried them off with the towel that everyone else was using, and then did what you were doing. It's either that autopsy or you were delivering a child. So this is from the Encyclopedia Britannica, documents that in 1845, a doctor in Vienna was horrified at the terrible death rate of women who gave birth in hospitals. As many as 30% died after giving birth. 1845, 1500 BC, God said, use running water. The doctor noted that doctors would examine patients who died, did an autopsy, then go straight to the next ward and examine expectant mothers. This was normal practice because no one had any idea that there were microscopic diseases. The concept was not around. He started insisting doctors wash their hands in running water, and the death rate dropped to 2%. 30% to 2%, 1845. And yet God said, no. You need to wash your hands under running water. Which is interesting. It's why we do it today. Because as science has been able to see what's on your hands, a lot of the reason you do so, the soap's important, it's all part of the cleaning process, but a lot of what happens is this. With water pouring over your hands, rinsing them clean, because you're breaking all the bacteria and gook away, and it just keeps pouring over your hands. And it's the running of water over your hands. Soap breaks it down, helps break everything down, of course. But it's the running water that makes the big difference. You dip your hand in dirty water. If you have a child, look at the bathtub after they have a bath. and tell me if still water is a good thing or not. Our son has now fixated on taking showers, which is a wonderful thing for your schedule. He's in, he's out, but so we're just applying hygiene laws. That's all we're doing in the household. So yeah, from 30% to 2%. Okay, let's go to Numbers 19, a little more to this one. How did they know to use running water? That would mean you would had to have a source of it. So unless they lived near a stream, they had to bring it somewhere and then pour it. That's counterintuitive to want to be able to dump water to be able to create running water. So they had to go down to a stream. So Numbers 19, you're going there? It's just a coincidence, right? Chapter 19, verse 11. He that touches the dead body of any man shall be unclean 7 days. He shall purify himself, verse 12, with it on the third day, and on the seventh day he shall be clean. But if he purifies not himself on the third day, then on the seventh day he shall not be clean. Purification process, the heifer, the ash, and they mix it together. There actually is properties in that. And also talks later about hyssop, which is antibacterial, things that they simply wouldn't have known. In verse 21, continuing, and it shall be a perpetual statute unto them about how you deal with dead bodies, how you must stay clean, and how you have to do these specific cleanses and purifications, both the ritual, the sacrifice, and also the physical cleaning. He that sprinkles the water of separation shall wash his clothes, and he that touches the water of separation shall be unclean until even. So essentially, so you have the water of separation and using to clean you, using to clean things. And then God says, nope, give it till evening. So it's like you're going to take a shower and wash down, and God says, no, don't consider yourself clean for a few more hours. Maybe let it dry off. Just completely dry out anything that may be wet or could grow on you. Interesting with hand sanitizer. It's the drying out process. That's why if you slop a lot of hand sanitizer on, your hands are all wet, and you walk around, you're like, okay, I'm done. You actually just moved the bacteria around. It's the drying out process that kills off the bacteria. So that's why you keep rubbing your hands until they're squeaky. That's the part that helps. Just like any substance, when it dries off, that's the point when it breaks it down. Alcohol does a better job of it. So God says, no, wait until evening. Let everything dry completely before you are considered clean. Do you know it wasn't really understood until really very modern times that when you die, or anything dies, it starts to decompose. And that process of decomposition introduces bacteria that help with the process, but also introduces bacteria that can make you very, very sick. So what does God say? No. Be very careful with a dead body. Be careful with any carcass, because when it's dead, he knows, he created us, it's starting to break down. It's starting to create bacteria inside of it. It's starting to have the potential to make you very sick. No one knew that then, because it's not the common practice. People would just die. And there were burial ceremonies from different cultures, but not in the cleanliness way that God inspired the Israelites to do. It's very, very specific on how they handled it. Most everything else was more based around some sort of ritual. But God said, no. How you handle these dead carcasses, people or animals, is very, very specific, because there can be consequences that get you sick. Leviticus 11. Let's just jump in through the books of the Torah here, those first five books. Again, 1400 B.C. So 3,400 years ago. Copper, iron, glass. That was the technology of the time. Shoes. And yet we're talking about microscopic bacteria that could make you sick. Chapter 11. If we thought it was just people, this is why God was very, very careful and specific. Again, you couldn't have known this, and this was not the practice of the time. People never thought about this. Verse 33, chapter 11, "In every earthen vessel, wherein any of them falls, something dead, a carcass, whatsoever is in it shall be unclean." Doesn't matter what it is, if something dead falls in, it's unclean, and you shall break it, destroy it, because you could have bacteria growing in it. "All of the meat, of all meat which may be eaten, that on which such water comes shall be unclean." So if you have something dead fall in water, God says don't even use it to clean meats, because that meat will then become unclean. Think about the sanitation practices today and how careful we are in modern society, and we still have salmonella outbreaks. But God very specifically inspired these instructions. Continuing here, verse 35, "And everything whereupon any part of their carcass falls shall be unclean." Any part, whether it be oven or ranges for pots, they shall be broken down, for they are unclean and shall be unclean unto you. God understood if diseases broke out, they could be spread. So he said, the way we do this is stop it before they can spread. Verse 36, "Nevertheless, a fountain or pit wherewith there's plenty of water shall be clean, but that which touches their carcass shall be unclean." Did you notice the differentiation? God said, if there's a large body of water, then don't worry about it. Because we understand in the modern age, that bacteria would be diffused in that large body of water, and there'd be so little to affect us, it wouldn't be a problem. But if it's a small one, then you don't do it. Or a fountain, in this case, too, is also showing fresh water continually coming up. How did he know? How did Moses write that? Obviously, we have a perspective that most don't, but remember, everything that was being taught in this time, everything that was being introduced, was radically different than what was understood 3,500, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. These words were not something that could be compared to some other writing, and they put together bits and pieces of different cultures to come up with what we have in the Bible. Things were introduced in the Bible that were completely outside of what anyone knew. Totally new. Totally unique. And completely provable with modern science. Brethren, modern science gives us our pillar in the cloud, fire, pillars, manna from heaven moments. Because it allows us to see what God did thousands of years ago and prove it today. Because we couldn't, without modern technology, be able to see it. So God forbid drinking from vessels or stagnant water because it could be contaminated. Yet people did it all the time outside the nation of Israel and then died. It wasn't until about 100 years ago that we understood that typhoid and cholera could just be sitting there in the water when something was dead. Yeah, those are some laws of hygiene. Let's go look at some other here. Laws of quarantine. Leviticus 13, jumping back or ahead a couple chapters. Last time we zoomed out to the universe, now we're zooming into microscopic bacteria and diseases and all the fun stuff that terrifies clean freaks and germaphobes. So Leviticus 13 and verse 46. Verse 46 reads, "All the days wherein the plague shall be in him, he shall be defiled." Talking about leprosy. "He is unclean. He shall dwell alone." Put him "without the camp shall his habitation be." When someone comes down with a disease, in this case focusing on leprosy, you put him out of the camp. Okay, that makes sense. Of course, it's contagious. It only makes sense because we understand things can be contagious in our modern age. There was no concept that diseases could spread in any other way. For years, we'll see this later, they thought you breathed in bad vapor and that's how you got sick. You see a certain way, but they thought it got in your blood. That's, you breathe in vapor and then bad vapors got in your blood. You could breathe it in your lungs and your stomach, you'd be fine. But if vapor got into your blood, then that's why you got sick. But that was thousands of years later. So God says, if someone has leprosy, put him outside the camp because he's contagious. It was the 17th century, that we understood that you should quarantine for disease. Stop and let that sink in for a moment. You were talking about a few hundred years ago, we finally understood that we should quarantine when people or animals are sick. And here in God's word, again, over 3,000 years ago, he said quarantine. No one did it besides Israel. It was not done. For hundreds of years, we'll see even more. Thousands of years. The Encyclopedia of Medical History. How unique is this? The idea of contagion was foreign to classic medical tradition and found no place in the voluminous Hippocratic writings. So the early part of a couple thousand years ago. So no part in the basic documents that define modern medicine. The Old Testament, however, is rich for contagious sentiment, especially in regard to leprosy and venereal disease. Thousands of years before, the Bible clearly says things can be contagious, and the base of modern medicine didn't even understand it when the first things were written about it. Coincidence? Another quote from the History of Medicine. During the devastating Black Death of the 14th century, bubonic plague, patients who were sick or dead were kept in the same room as the rest of the family because they just died. You didn't do a lot with bodies back then because you didn't think anything of it. People often wondered why disease was affecting so many people at one time. They attributed these epidemics to bad air. It was bad air, dead body sitting next to you, but just the air in general was bad air. Or evil spirits. However, careful attention to the medical commands of God and revealed in Leviticus, again, the History of Medicine reading from here. Careful attention to the medical commands of God as revealed in Leviticus would have saved untold millions of lives. The overwhelming importance of the biblical medical law, the laws against leprosy in Leviticus 13 may be regarded as the first model of sanitary legislation. The first model, thousands of years ago, before the bubonic plague hit Europe. Brethren, this is the God we serve. He created our bodies. He created the universe, right down to the tiniest little bacteria, and he knows how to manage them because he would have them. He knew. He created this delicate balance, the ecosystem in the world, how it survives. So you need the bacteria. You need all of the organisms to balance the entire system out, so of course he would know how we should interact with it to be able to keep ourselves healthy, to be able to avoid it getting out of control and having things like a bubonic plague. Here's back a verse in that same chapter, Leviticus 13, verse 45. It's a fun one here. And the leper in whom the plague is, his clothes shall be rent and his head bare, and he shall put a covering on his upper lip and shall cry, unclean, unclean. Socially distant, socially distant. You laugh, but that's exactly what that means. Keep your distance. I'm a leper. I'm unclean. I don't want to cough on you. So I'm going to cover my mouth. They had no idea germs and bacteria could be spread as particles through the air because they didn't even understand in the time that things were contagious. Yet God says, cover your mouth. I don't know, maybe face coverings are a good thing. But it's why we're told, teach little kids, cough in your sleeve. You don't want to spread your germs. That's second nature to us because of what we understand. But it was completely foreign 3,000 years ago. It was completely foreign 1,000 years ago, or even 500 years ago. But yet here we are, God saying, cover your mouth, socially distance when you are sick, go outside the camp, and make sure everything is cleaned. Quarantine those that are sick. Again, I ask, is it just a lucky choice of words that Moses put on paper or on those scrolls that happened to line up with how God designed our bodies to be able to function and the microbes and various organisms that exist around us just happened to get it right? Okay, let's look at sanitation laws. Deuteronomy 23. Let's go back in time as you turn there. Deuteronomy 23. It's 1846. We're in London. London, England. Nearly 3 million people lived in London in 1846. Its population was doubling like every several years. It was incredible how fast it was growing. It was the center, essentially, of the world at the time. 3 million people. And then there was a cholera epidemic. 16,000 people died very, very fast, and it's out of control for some time later. What they didn't really understand at the time, and this seems very foreign to us, they had toilets. They had facilities. Most of the houses, because you had high-rise, you had two- and three-story buildings, lining streets, horses. They would just simply pat the manure down for horses to kind of pat down the road. And you think, oh, really? Well, I guess it's horse manure. It's kind of good. It's compost, right? But that's not the only thing they did, because they didn't actually have flushing toilets. They just had a can of sorts and whatever facility they would do it in. And so they would take that refuse, if you will, walk over to their window and dump it into the street. 3 million people would do that. Let that grossness sink in. There would be feet of manure on the street because it was just dumped there. You think, okay, no wonder they had cholera outbreaks. That's crazy. But most, actually everyone thought, you know what? It's not because of that. Because of that, it's because of bad air or evil spirits causing the problem in 1846. And what did God say in Deuteronomy 23? Look at verse 12. You shall have a place also without the camp, hopefully not next to the lepers, where you should go forth abroad. This is almost politically correct writing. I love this, the way God describes this. And you shall have a paddle upon your weapon. So you have this paddle you're carrying with you. And it shall be for when you will ease yourself abroad. You shall dig therewith and shall turn back and cover it that which comes from you. Okay, so you basically put it in a hole and cover it. For the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give up your enemies before you, and therefore your camp should be holy, and I see no unclean thing in you and turn away from you. So God frames it with, you're going to irritate me if you don't follow this sanitation law. So basically God very, very set a high bar, because he could have said, just do this and people may or may not, but he attached it to himself because God, of course, understood how dangerous it would be if sewage was left in the camp. Think cholera outbreak. So God said, again, over 3,000 years ago, you have to remove the sewage away from where you are without the camp. And not just that, bury it. Because what would happen if it was just open sewers, that's essentially what you had in London. You were closer to it, but it was an open sewer, and then people would get sick. Go back a little further to the 1350s. So we're still looking, compared to when Deuteronomy is written, modern times. That was also another bubonic plague outbreak. It was estimated that Jews during this one in 1350, it's also in Europe, died at a rate of half of everyone else. 50% less death in Jewish communities than everyone else because they followed all of the things that we've talked about thus far. They removed their refuse outside the camp. They cleaned things with running water. They washed their hands. When someone was sick, they quarantined them. It was so effective and so dramatically different from the people around them. The Jews were blamed for some of the plagues because obviously they're behind it. The 50% who died still, or even though there was less, they were still dying in great numbers. But they were blamed for it because their proclivity to get it and die from it was so much less because they were following God's laws that he established thousands and thousands of years before. Okay, that's sanitation. We looked at quarantine, some health, sanitation. Here's one that we all know well. God has a set of food laws. And we take these for granted. We don't think about them. We don't eat unclean meats. Of course not. That's what God says, so we don't eat unclean meats. And we know some things. Most of us know about pig and swine and trichinosis and some of the things that can come from it. But every single item on the list where God says you can't eat has a specific reason. We'll look at every detail. You can do this on your own, but turn to Leviticus 11. We'll read through a bunch of this chapter. Just a coincidence? Or did God inspire the book that sits on your lap? We'll start in verse 1. Chapter 11, verse 1, and the Lord spoke unto Moses and to Aaron, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, these are the beasts which you shall eat among all the beasts that are on the earth. Whatsoever parts the hoof and is cloven-footed and chews the cud among the beasts, that you shall eat, cow and sheep and goat. Nevertheless, these shall you not eat of them that chew the cud, but them divide the hoof, so giving you the opposite. So whatsoever part, let's pick it up here in verse 4 here. Nevertheless, these shall you not eat of them that chew the cud or of them that divide the hoof as a camel. So God says there's some that look like they're okay, but I'm specifically calling out the camel, don't eat the camel. Because he chews the cud but divides not the hoof, he is unclean to you. Okay, let's get into the specifics of them. Look at those hooves. What are they doing with the food? How are they just eating it? And the coney, which chews the cud but divides not the hoof, he's unclean to you. The hare, because he chews the cud and divides not the hoof, he is unclean to you. And the swine, because he divides the hoof and be cloven-footed, yet he chews not the cud, he is unclean to you. So different variations on that. Highly specific on animals that look very, very similar. Well, we know about pork, and actually most of the meats that God defines as you can't eat have that same problem with parasites. Pork is particularly bad, so much so that the FDA recognizes that pork's bad for you, and you can't go into a restaurant and say, I would like a medium rare pork chop. They will make it because it can make you sick. No one connects the dots and say, maybe I shouldn't have a well-done pork chop either. But they always cook them well done because that's the only way you can kill off the parasite. You're never going to find pork carpaccio, but you can do that with beef. Okay, we'll continue on here. Verse 8. Verse 8 reads, of their flesh shall you not eat, and the carcass you shall not touch. They are unclean to you. Remember the context of the things you can't. And then changing subjects, these shall you eat of that are in the waters. Okay, so now we've moved to the waters. Whatsoever has fins and scales in the waters, in the seas, and in the rivers, them shall you eat. There's a lot of stuff in the ocean, but very few things that have fins and scales. And all that have not fins and scales in the seas and in the rivers, and All that move in the waters, and of any living thing which is in the waters, they shall be an abomination unto you. So God just narrowed what you can pull out of the ocean to a very specific group of fish. This is only the only thing you're going to have in the ocean with fins and scales are fish. And there's a lot of fish that don't have scales. So that's a very narrow portion of what is in the ocean. If you've ever gone in a river and scooped stuff up and you have crawfish and worms and tadpoles and salamanders, all sorts of things that you would think you can eat. That's food. But God specifically says, no, don't eat all of those things. Because another interesting thing he did, those items that tend to be crawling around in the ocean or have soft skin do one of two things. They're predators, so they're eating the flesh of another animal in the ocean. Oftentimes, the things that are crawling along the bottom that aren't good for you. Or they're bottom feeders. So you think about the fish, catfish. There's one that you can't help but think about. They can grow large, and they just vacuum up junk off the bottom of water. We have some in the lake because they're good at vacuuming stuff up. That's what they do. They clean. If you ever have a fish tank, you see that one little miniature catfish that you always have in the fish tank that's always stuck on the side of the glass because he's cleaning it, because that's what they do. That's why God said, don't eat the vacuum cleaner. Because it's pulling up all sorts of junk. So they consume waste, and what do they also do? They tend to carry disease because they're just eating all the junk of the bacteria off the bottom. And they're designed to be able to handle a lot of disease. It's like pigs. They can just go eat and eat poisonous snakes. Just chomp them like there's no one's business, and it doesn't affect them because they're designed to vacuum up garbage. Again, how did the Bible exist in a time when that was written? Because most of these, especially with food, you can eat these things and won't immediately get sick. That's what's inspiring about the health laws. So none of these items, because you get people who just are hog wild over bacon. They just bacon. That's there are restaurants dedicated to pig and bacon. And they stay in business because people don't drop dead when they walk out of the restaurants. You die over time. And all of these other things, lobster and catfish, and you go down the list of unclean things, and we'll keep looking at here, they don't kill you instantly. So unless this was inspired of God, how would they have known they're not healthy without the modern science that we have today to be able to show why God picked these specific things? Like, we're destroying the earth now because we're introducing things like mercury and it's getting into fish and things that are clean, but that's our fault. That's not how they were designed. But you go measure mercury in animals that are not clean, you will find they have higher levels, especially the predators, because they're not designed to release toxins in the same way that clean fish are designed to do, because that's how God made them. So if they eat the smaller ones, you don't get the buildup. That's where mercury poisoning comes from. Okay, that's the fins and scales. Verse 13 of the same chapter, chapter 11. And these are they which have an abomination among the fowls. They should not be eaten. They are an abomination, an eagle. That's an offspray and various birds, vulture, kite. These are all birds, predator birds, birds of prey. Raven, after his kind, the owl, the nighthawk, the cuckoo, the hawk. Little owl, so it's the big owl and the little owl. Don't eat either of them. The cormorant, the great owl, the swan, the pelican, another eagle, the stork, the heron, lapwing, and the bat. It's a funny one out of the middle of nowhere. You think, okay, all the other ones are really pretty birds, most of them at least. And so I could think maybe I'm going to want to eat one of those attractive birds. And then the bat. You think, okay, does anyone... The irony is, bats are consumed all over the world. They're considered a delicacy in many, many cultures. And bad things happen. Think COVID. And a lot of diseases can be traced back to bats because bats have this funny thing about them. they take in parasites and diseases and viruses and can carry ones that have a similar thumbprint, if you will, to ones humans can carry. So bats are very good at transmitting viruses that wouldn't get into people. That's a lot easier to do when you're sitting down eating the bat. But you think no one does it, but it's super common and it's considered a delicacy. And there's a little, you can argue in some cases, they've linked it to a few other things, but at least COVID-19, the modern one. But there's a lot of evidence showing bats and a lot of COVIDs, not our modern one, have come from bats and a lot of other diseases too. So that's why we're told not to eat them. And birds of prey, they don't distinguish between live and dead. They'll eat anything. So they'll eat dead food, dead carcasses. Remember what God said about dead carcasses. What are they carrying? But birds are designed to be able to handle it. But if we eat the birds that are eating the carcasses that have the parasites that don't bother them, they will bother and make us sick. But not immediately, always. So how in the world did they know to write that unless God inspired those words? Because again, remember, we're talking about thousands of years ago. They were excited about shoes. Shoes. It was still 1,000 years or so after porcelain was invented before people really started to see it. It was in China, kind of hidden away. Iron was a big deal. And yet, the Bible clearly talks about parasites and bacteria that we wouldn't understand until the modern age. Okay, verse 20, same chapter. All fowls that creep, going on all four, shall be an abomination unto you. Yet these which may eat of every flying, creeping thing that goes on all fours, which have legs above their feet to leap wherewith upon the earth, even of these of them you'll eat, the locust after his kind, the bald locust after his kind, the beetle after his kind, the grasshopper after his kind. Do so at your own risk. They're clean, but I heard if you cover them with chocolate, they're good. But I've heard you cover pretty much anything with chocolate, and it's good. So the grasshopper after his kind. And then jump down to verse 29. These are also be unclean unto you among the creeping things that creep upon the earth, the weasel, the mouse, and the tortoise after his kind. Think rats and all of the diseases they've spread. Yet no one would have any idea, because if rats were clean, this is a disgusting thought because of our modern age and we know what's wrong with them. Think how mice reproduce or how rats reproduce. We'd be farming rats all over the place, but they carry diseases. And so God says, before it's possible to even understand, don't eat the mice and the ferret and the chameleon and the lizard and the snail and the mole. These are unclean to you among all that creep. Whatsoever does touch them, when they are dead, shall be unclean even until evening. So again, it's dead. Be careful with it. So why all these things besides it's just kind of gross? There's actually more science. 90% of contamination rate, 90% contamination rate of salmonella if you eat lizards, salamanders, or other amphibians. So you will get salmonella poisoning if you eat amphibians, lizards, salamanders. That's just one problem. There are a slew of different sicknesses and illnesses you can get if you eat reptiles or rodents. And you think, well, of course, no one's going to eat them. But they did. People ate anything that moved. It was food. It was protein. That's what they went after. The concept of farming, remember, was just really starting to be established in Europe. It wasn't even something that was done heavily in Latin America. They had farms, but not on the scale. So they were eating whatever they could get their hands on all around the world. So for God to inspire that you shouldn't eat certain things was a radical idea and completely outside of the norm. 90% contamination rate for salmonella. Exodus 22. A little more warnings here. Exodus 22, verse 31. Probably should have sent you to Leviticus, but we'll do this one and then go back to Leviticus. Verse 31 of chapter 22, verse 31. And you shall be holy men unto me, neither shall you eat any flesh that is torn of beasts in the field. So clean animals that are killed in the field, you shall cast it to the dogs. You don't even try to eat that, even if it's clean because it's dead and it has microorganisms in it that could make you sick. Leviticus 22:8. We'll jump back there again. Chapter 22. Just looking at the same point. Chapter 22 and verse 8. Verse 8 reads, "That which dies of itself or is torn with beasts." So if you have an animal that, say you had a herd, sheep or goats at the time, and you had a goat fall and die. God says, get rid of it, or if it's torn with beasts, we saw in Exodus 22, he shall not eat to defile himself therewith. I am the Lord. It's a command of God. Because do you know if that beast fell and hit its head and died? Or was that beast full of disease and just happened to die at the time? You couldn't tell because no one had any idea of microorganisms. The concept didn't exist. So God didn't get into, well, there are these tiny little bacterium that are inside these things that you need to understand. So no, of course not. He just said, don't eat it if it's dead. Could we today learn that if something is dead and you find it, you can cut away the dead parts and learn and cook it and we have a modern age. We can figure that out. No one had a microscope at the time to look at the meat and see if it was decaying or if it wasn't. So God said, no, I'm going to pull back a little bit. I'm going to draw the parameters around the fence around what you shouldn't do a little wider to prevent you from getting disease. Remember, bubonic plague, they thought it was bad air that was getting them sick, evil spirits. And that was 2,500 years after God inspired this to be written. 2,500 years. Because today we understand a dying carcass is full of disease. We know it. It's something we understand. We take it for granted. It's knowledge that's automatic to us. So we have to take off our modern bias. And remember, okay, this was not common. This was abstract. This was odd, radical, totally different than what they understood. Okay, that's really a brief look at food. The food laws, you can keep going. Dig through Leviticus 11, look up different creatures, and you can find information on each of the defined items as to why that we've learned in the modern age why you shouldn't eat them. God is very specific on what he allows us to do and not do. Okay, so one final one here. Blood. Okay, what does that have to do with amazing discoveries? Go to Leviticus 17. Again, another one of those items we just know in the modern age. It's just part of our base knowledge. We don't think about it being very unique. Chapter 17 and verse 10. Verse 10 reads, "And whatsoever man there be of the house of Israel, of strangers that sojourn among you, that eats any manner of blood, I will even set my face against the soul that eats blood, and I will cut him off among his people." Think of the context of this time was a lot of consumption of blood. Ritualistic cultures, that's what they did. They killed and they sacrificed, they drank blood. This was normal. To say, don't drink blood, was the radical, different, completely unique position. But God said, I'll cut you off if you drink blood. For the life of the flesh is in the blood. And I have given to you upon the altar to make an atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes the atonement for the soul. Therefore I said unto the children of Israel, no soul of you shall eat blood, driving the point home because everyone did. outside of the nation of Israel, everyone did. Neither shall any stranger that sojourns among you eat blood. Whatsoever man there be of the children of Israel or strangers that sojourn among you, which hunts and catches any beast or fowl that may be eaten, he shall even pour out the blood thereof, so drain it properly before eating, and cover it with dust. So don't even leave the blood exposed, because like decomposing anything else, it's going to decay and have bacteria. For it is the life of the flesh, the blood of it is for the life thereof. God says life is in the blood. Did you know, up until the 19th century, we thought we got sick? 19th century, so a couple hundred years ago. We thought we got sick because bad vapors got in our blood. We didn't know what or why or how particles trap. So it was some sort of bad vapor. They would have assumed it was some sort of smoke or something in the air, because otherwise they didn't really understand wind or currents, or that there were particles in the air that float in the air if you couldn't see them, because they couldn't see things microscopically. So it's essentially bad smoke got in your blood, and that made you sick. So how do you get better? You get the bad smoke out. So get the vapors out of your blood. So how do you get the bad vapors out of your blood? You put a leech on your body and let it suck the blood out. And people wonder why we second-guess medicine. Leeches. Extremely common. Or if you were really sick, cut open at the wrist and bleed out to let the bad blood, the vapors, bleed out of the system. And then people died because they bled out and they just couldn't get enough vapor out, and they never connected the dot that they just let the person bleed to death. We now know that the blood supplies life. It's our nourishment. Without blood flowing through our system, we die. Without it having the oxygen. So the two systems that are so crucial. What do they do if you are an injury or hurt? They make sure your blood is pumping and your lungs are breathing. If your heart's not pumping and your lungs aren't breathing to get oxygen, you're dead. There's nothing you can do to bring that person back. You're dead. Because the life, the nutrients, including what comes from the oxygen, is in the blood. It goes to every part of your body. Nutrients for your muscles, your joints, your bones, everywhere is distributed through your body to keep you alive in your blood. How would they even have known that blood goes through your entire body then? In your bones. And everywhere that it allows it to get all of that nutrients throughout your body. This was so common and so cutting edge, really no pun intended on the cutting edge there, that George Washington got a cold. They understand now, looking back, it was a common cold. So he just got particularly sick, and the doctors came in and drained 40% of his blood, and it killed him. That was how off we are, or were, and still are in many ways, we come to understand, from what God inspired. So the first president of the United States died because we thought there was bad vapor in our blood. And blood can also be full of disease. It can carry disease and encapsulate it and keep it and help get it out of your system too, which is interesting, which is another reason why you cover that blood with dust to prevent that from happening. Consider that. Brethren, like the universe, the Bible cannot get any medical fact wrong, or it's not God's word. It doesn't have to have every medical fact. This is not the book of all knowledge, but any knowledge in it has to be accurate. And not only is it so, everything we've seen, and there are more that I wouldn't have had time to cover, but thousands of years before mankind could even begin to understand it. Several thousand years. So what's the purpose of two sermons like this? Interesting. It's amazing. It's neat. The Bible is impressive. This information's around. Professing Christianity understands several of these things. But they don't have the connection to our Creator that you and I get to experience. They don't understand all of the other truths of the Bible that you and I have. These facts, these proofs of science, should strengthen our faith on everything else we understand. So if there's any question in your life where you think, oh, I'm struggling with this, that, or the other, your faith wavers. The God that put all of these things in the Bible, from the universe to microscopic organisms, is in charge of your life, guiding your life, directing your life. Don't ever let that escape from your mind. We looked at big things before and small things today. The Bible confirms science, and science confirms the Bible. But that's just interesting. This should solidify us in our Creator to remember, we see great miracles today. The God that inspired 3,000 years ago to record things that were impossible to understand, did he do it for no reason? Think about that. Did he do it for no reason? He just wanted to put it in his word. Or did God, who stands outside of space and time, say, there'll be a point where I have servants at the end of the age who have a world that's difficult, the world that pulls on them, that they have to struggle through and fight. So I'm going to put in my word thousands of years ago something that they'll only be able to come to understand in their lifetime. Brethren, that's the God we serve. So when we ever think that he's not guiding our lives, or we're in a trial, or whatever the circumstances are, whatever our faith wavers, remember, God can inspire things thousands of years before they can be understood, and can direct our lives in the direction it needs to go to be part of the family of God. Never forget it. We serve the God of the universe, and that God watches over, directs, guides, and will help us make it to the kingdom of God. Do not forget it, and never lose grasp of it.